From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During this last week of the summer season, we're featuring a retrospective of some of our favorite interviews from the recent past. On today's Fresh Air, how to pick up an accent or how to lose one. We talk with speech therapist Sam Schwa. He helped Robert De Niro lose his New York accent and pick up an Appalachian one for the movie Cape Fear. Then we'll hear from an actor who sounds very New York, Nathan Lane. He's the voice of Timon Meerkat in The Lion King. He played Nathan Detroit in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Fresh, about a 12-year-old drug runner in New York. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Robert De Niro needed to learn a Southern accent for his role in Cape Fear, he worked with my guest, Sam Schwa. Kathleen Turner, Andy McDowell, Julia Roberts, Danny Glover, and Gregory Hines also worked with Schwa when their roles required accents. Schwa is a speech therapist and dialect coach. He specializes in helping actors learn accents and helping immigrants lose their accents. He's the founder of New York Speech Improvement Services. His accent elimination program called Speak Up has just been published in a book and cassette package. Schwa is from Brooklyn, but he lost his accent. I asked him to describe the weather just so we could listen to how he speaks now.
Well, the weather today is relatively humid and muggy, and the sun is out, but it's rather damp outside.
So how did you used to speak?
Well, I would say that it was more humid and it was more muggy, and it's not so comfortable outside, if you know what I mean.
Now, did you work at changing your accent, or did it naturally evolve?
No, I had to work at it consistently. I found that some of my clients were picking up absolutely the wrong cues from me, and they were walking out with a New York accent when I needed them to have no accent at all, what I call a standard American accent.
Now, I noticed when you first gave us the weather report, you said humid.
Mm-hmm.
And when you did it New York style, it was humid.
That's very clever of you. That's right. In this area, that H disappears before the Y sound. So instead of humid and humor and humidity and human, we have human and Yuma and humidity and humanity.
What are some of the reasons people come to you to either gain or lose accents?
The typical reasons people come to us is because they sound distracting from their content, that people are listening to how they're saying their words instead of to what they're saying. This could be deadly if you're doing a commercial. It could be deadly if you're giving a business presentation. And other reasons people come is because they find that they're stigmatized as being members of a discriminated subgroup. I sound too black. I sound too New York. I sound too Southern. I sound too German. Or they feel that parts of their speech make them unintelligible, difficult to understand, because most people are expecting standard American speech, which is an easier pattern for most people to understand.
Some of your clients are actors and actresses who need to learn dialects or accents for roles they have to play.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps the most celebrated example of this was Robert De Niro, who needed to, I guess, lose his New York accent and pick up an Appalachian one for Cape Fear.
That's right. We worked very, very hard and long on that one, and he did beautifully in that in Cape Fear. We also studied together for him to replace his New York accent with a standard American accent in the movie This Boy's Life. And I also worked with Kathleen Turner and Isabella Rossellini and Tony Danza and Julia Roberts and Andy McDowell. Both lost their Southern accents with me before their movie careers took off.
Now, I'd like to play a clip from Cape Fear in which we'll hear Robert De Niro and Nick Nolte. And this is early on in the movie where Robert De Niro has come back to haunt Nick Nolte, who was his former lawyer. Robert De Niro has just gotten out of prison.
Okay.
What is the formula for compensation, sir.
Well, how about $10,000 in cash?
Well, let's just break that down.
No, wait a minute. You see, that figure just came to the top of my head.
Well, let's just say, for argument's sake, let's say $20,000, let's say $30,000. I tell you what, let's say $50,000. $50,000 into 14 years. 14 years times 365 days is about, I'd say about 5,000 days. Now, you divide that by $50,000, and that's like $10 a day. That's not even minimum wage. To say nothing about the family that I lost, the respect that I lost. I don't think you really, really understand what we're talking about here. 14 years.
It's Robert De Niro and Nick Nolte in Cape Fear. So what are we listening to there when we hear Robert De Niro speaking that's different from how he'd speak normally?
Well, what you're hearing is mostly vowels that are changed. For example, instead of family, or as he might say, family, you are hearing a more nasal quality to the A in family. Instead of lost, which is what he would do for L-O-S-T, you're hearing more of a loust. Instead of the vowel I, which never exists in any part of the South, you have ah, the family that I lost, instead of what I would say, the family that I lost, or what he would say, the family that I lost, there's also very deep-chested vowels that come in there, disappearing L's after vowels, tell you what, instead of tell you what. The forced R's in the formula, and additional R's as at the end of that word, the formula for compensation, sir, instead of what he might normally do, the formula for compensation, sir. So these are some of the changes that we went through word for word through the script and all through the shooting in Fort Lauderdale at the time.
Now, listening back, do you think any New York-isms still seep into his Southern dialect?
Well, actually, yeah. I was sorry you brought that up. But when he says here and years, he's dropping those R's, whereas someone from Appalachia would force those R's and would say here and years. But that's about the only fluke in that passage. And he's so consistent through those lines that I don't think anybody would take him for anything but an Appalachian Southerner.
How did you work with De Niro? Spend like 3 months with him?
We spent 3 months before the shooting meeting, say, 2 to 3 hours, 5 to 6 days a week, and all through the shooting in Fort Lauderdale with me tapping him on the shoulder between takes. And we did it spontaneously off the script in sample conversations. We called up department stores and asked for product information or product availability, and we went through every word of the script until he got every line down perfectly.
How did you find the right accent for him? As you often point out, Southern accents vary from region to region.
Well, they say that accents change every 50 miles because of the isolation of communities historically. There's been some leavening of that issue of accents overall with people's mobility over time and the influence of radio and television. But the way we identified this accent was we sat down and analyzed the videotapes of Southern prisoners, people who were put in Appalachian prisons for extremely violent crimes, men of about his age, white men of about his age, and we listened to them until he said, "That's the guy I want to sound like, that one right there." And we analyzed this guy's accent and saw how far De Niro's New York accent was from this, and we worked on sound replacements. Where he would do one thing and I expect another, that's where we drilled for it.
You've also worked with Danny Glover, Isabella Rossellini. What did you do with Danny Glover?
He worked with me on the Saint of Fort Washington, and he needed a New York black accent for that role as a homeless person. And Isabella Rossellini needed a more intelligible Italian accent for commercials that she was doing for a cosmetic company.
What did you show Danny Glover about an accent in New York when he was playing somebody homeless?
Well, D's for TH's, like dis and dat and dem and does, and where we have ENs and EMs, for example, in Remember When, I taught him to do more of IN and IM, as in remember when, and features such as those.
Sam Schwa is my guest. He's the founder of New York Speech Improvement Services. We'll take a break and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is speech therapist and dialect coach Sam Schwa. He's published his Speak Up Accent Elimination Program in book and cassette form. Do you have any idea of why Southern accents differ so much from, say, New York accents?
Oh, absolutely. They all derive from the original colonial patterns of speech. Depending on where those colonial immigrants came from, that's what caused the genesis of these accents. For example, in New York, Southern English people, say from the London area, settled and they drop R's after vowels. So whereas a modern Southern English speaker would drop an R after a vowel in words such as here and there and more and New York, the same pattern developed in New York where we also drop R's after vowels, as in here, there, more, and New York. In parts of the Deep South, parts of Appalachian South, there was a Scottish-based influence where the bird R became diluted into more of a forced R that remains today, as opposed to the rest of the South, which borrowed from Southern England, and those R's after vowels dropped in different ways, as in here and there and more and New York.
When you listen to, say, news anchors on television, do you find that most of them have a very standard American way of speaking, or can you detect regionalisms in their voices?
Well, you can always hear Peter Jennings' Canadianisms come out, but by and large, those people are chosen because they have pretty much unremarkable ways of speech. You wind up to listening to what they're saying and not to how they're saying it, and they're very good actors for the limited type of acting that they do. But the most important thing about those people, or people who aspire to those jobs, is that they have accents that don't reveal where they're from. Their accents are identifiably American, very easy to understand, and you listen to their content and not to their style.
You mentioned Peter Jennings' Canadianisms. I used to live in Buffalo, New York, and listen to Canadian radio a lot while I was there. And I picked up what I think is a Canadian, instead of about.
Mm-hmm.
Is it typical for people when they live in a place with a different accent than the one they were brought up in that they'll just pick up haphazardly on certain things, whether they realize it or not?
Well, people are adaptable to different degrees. One fact that I'm sure of is that the bulk of your accent does develop between the ages of 3 years and 7 years, and it's based on where you grow up and among which peers you grow up, as opposed to your parents and what accents they speak. You can think about people in your family or people in your past who were brought up in Europe and have identifiably European ways of speech, and if their children were brought up here between the ages of 3 years and 7 years, their accents reflect the community they grow up in rather than their parents' accents. People are adaptable after that age, there is some plasticity, some changeability in people depending on how adaptable they are and how long they're in a particular place and how much they're resisting or trying to blend into the area.
You know, a lot of women now, especially I think younger women, have the problem of speaking in a kind of high, uncertain voice. And going along with that is often that the ends of sentences end as if they were questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if a lot of women come into your office asking you to help them deepen their voices or sound more assertive.
Mm-hmm. That's an increasing request that we hear at New York Speech Improvement. We hear people come in who say that they sound wimpy or they're not respected as much. This is men and women. But we're seeing increasing numbers of women, especially as women swell the workforce and women want to rise more and be in hierarchies and bureaucracies and be taken more seriously. We do hear this this rising sort of inflection that goes up as if they're questioning everything that they're saying or can be talked out of it. We're hearing habitual uses of higher parts of their ranges, and people do want deeper pitches, which are held to sound more assertive.
Are there exercises that you give people who want to deepen their voice and take it out of the nasal cavity and bring it back down into the diaphragm?
Oh, sure. In the tapes, we have all sorts of tonal exercises which will help you explore your overall range. We help you understand that all of your range should be used, but that some parts should be used more habitually than others. And we have exercises that put you in touch with your lower pitches.
Can you give me a sample of one of those exercises, help me kind of place my voice deeper?
We can help you identify the more nasal range of your voice by speaking more through your nose, by forcing your speech more through your nose, and by comparing it with the most open-mouthed posture type of speech you can come out with. So, for example, instead of saying, my name is Sam, and I'm at New York Speech Improvement Services. More, we have you contrast that with, my name is Sam, and I am at. And we have you compare and contrast the feel and the sound of it. Usually what happens is that the feel is incredibly odd to the person as he's doing it. It does sound distorted, but we're looking for the greatest variation from your normal way of speech. Ironically, the nasal way, for people who speak nasally, usually feels best but sounds worst, especially when you're comparing it on a tape recording. And we have exercises that help you narrow the gap between the two so that you wind up with a comfortable way of speaking intelligibly with a non-nasal way of speech.
Say you were doing that exercise. How do you find the nasal part of the voice and how do you find that deep part?
The nasal voice is achieved by speaking with the mouth in as closed a position as possible, by keeping your teeth locked, gritted, and your lips parted to the smallest degree possible that will allow intelligible speech. So you can almost feel that my teeth are grit now and that I'm forcing my air, my voice out through my nose. The voice, remember, has only two routes out through the body. It can come out of the mouth or it can come out of the nose. It would rather come out of the mouth because that's the closer exit point from the voice box, from the voice box's perspective. The other voice is achieved by keeping your mouth in as open a position as possible, and you can even augment the sensation by putting your fingers on your sternum, your breastbone, and feeling that vibrate. It won't vibrate it as much or it won't vibrate at all while you're doing your nasal speech. And in fact, if you put your finger on your nose while you're doing that, you will feel more nasal vibration. So the goal is to have no nasal vibration and as much chest vibration as possible. It's what's called the difference between nasal voice and chest voice.
You have another interesting exercise to find the nasal versus the chest voice, and one is to keep your mouth closed and go,
Mm-hmm. Which is the most nasal sound you can produce.
Because everything's coming through your nose. All the air is coming through your nose.
Correct.
And then your nose really vibrates when you do that.
Right.
How can you figure out what's coming, how to get a chest tone?
Well, you can do the vowel ah. With your tongue as flat in your mouth as possible, your mouth as vertically oval as possible, and your jaw as low as possible. We call it the dental vowel because it's the one that the dentist wants you to use to say ah is about as non-nasal as you can get.
Good. So that should be useful in just helping people to locate their voice. You know, one thing I learned reading through your materials that you'd think I would have thought of before, but I actually hadn't, is that whether you're smiling or frowning will affect the way you sound. As you put it on in your booklet, you can tell on the radio when somebody's smiling because their voice sounds different.
Oh, and they absolutely are smiling. There's a peculiar brain mechanism that's actually traceable to a part of the brain that controls vocal emotion, and it's right next door to those cells in the deep brain which account for facial expression. So if you manipulate your face, frequently your voice will change. One funny exercise that we have is we have people grin while reading into a tape recorder a bloody, bloody story, a really grotesquely bloody story from a tabloid newspaper, and then play it back. It's not even their language. And all they were doing was grinning while they were reading the story. And they will sound like the most psychotic thing going as a result on the playback. The purpose of these exercises in helping you use your face while you're speaking is so that you can reduce the monotone effect that some people have, where their voice is very, very flat. You can be sure that their faces are not being used much at all. And if we help them throw in a smile or some facial flexibility, their voices will sound more colorful and more interesting and more pleasing to listen to.
You know how some people have a phony smile?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a phony voice that accompanies that kind of phony smile?
Sure, because if the smile looks non-genuine, there's almost a sarcastic edge to the voice. As much as you can hear me sort of falsely smiling now while I'm speaking, there's a false pleasantness that comes into the voice as a result. And people who overcompensate by using those types of facial expressions while they speak, those people are also coached by us to look more natural and to sound more natural.
I know a lot of immigrants come to you wanting to pick up English accents or to improve their English accents. Is there a group that you're seeing most of now?
Being New York, we see lots of people with Spanish accents, Indian accents, Russian accents are on the rise. These are people who are trying with great difficulty to assimilate into American society. They want to sound like Americans, and they have a very firm idea about what American accents should sound like, and they want to be taken as Americans rather than as an immigrant group.
Let's look at the Spanish accent that you see a lot of. Are there particular sounds that people from Spanish-speaking countries have trouble saying?
Oh, absolutely. One of the sounds is the TH. Statistically, of all the sounds in this language, the one that comes up more than any other is the TH. If you distort this one, you sound different. And Spanish frequently substitutes a D or a T for these THs. For example, instead of saying these, this, them, those, they're more likely to say dis, dis, them, dos. The Z sound does not occur in Spanish at all, and we have it quite frequently in words such as is, was, has, always, goes, please, which they pronounce routinely as an S. So they may say is, was, has, always, goes, please. We have a different kind of L from Spanish. So whereas I would say all and heel and I'll, they're more likely to say all, heel, I'll. And they will give a very nasal L to what we do quite non-nasally.
How do you teach somebody to change the L or change the TH? Just repetition?
It's a matter of teaching them to hear the difference, showing them how to produce the difference, showing them how it varies in different spellings, drilling them in phrases, and drilling them quite intensively in conversational speech, or teaching them how to self-monitor in conversational speech so that every time they hear it, they can self-correct, they know exactly what they're going for, exactly what they should be doing, and the more they learn to self-correct, the more they can rehabituate the way that they speak.
Sam Schwa, recorded in June. Schwa is the founder of New York Speech Improvement Services. His accent elimination program, Speak Up, is published in a book and cassette package. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, an actor who's sometimes even funnier than the lines that are written for him. We talk with Nathan Lane. He starred in Neil Simon's Broadway comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. And he was Nathan Detroit in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. Now he's the voice of Timon Meerkat in The Lion King. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Fresh, about a 12-year-old boy making tough choices as he grows up in the inner city. It features Samuel Jackson and Giancarlo Esposito. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. A top official of the Republic of Ireland says President Clinton was receptive today to his plea for help in supporting the Northern Ireland peace process. Deputy Prime Minister Dick Spring met with the president, who interrupted his Martha's Vineyard vacation for the talks. Spring says Mr. Clinton agreed to help with more financial aid.
President Clinton and I discussed what ways the American administration could be of assistance to this process. I want to say, as far as I'm concerned, that the President is totally committed. He has a genuine and serious commitment to assisting the Irish and British governments, and also assisting both communities in Northern Ireland, both the nationalist and unionist communities.
Spring told reporters the President had promised substantial sums of money, but White House spokeswoman Dee Dee Myers is stressing that Mr. Clinton only committed himself in principle because of budget realities and because Congress has to agree. Protestant extremists claimed responsibility today for killing a Roman Catholic man in Belfast, Northern Ireland. The outlawed Ulster Defense Association says its members shot to death John O'Hanlon as he repaired a car. The attack followed the start of the Irish Republican Army's ceasefire, and the president of the IRA's political wing, Gerry Adams, is appealing to his supporters not to rise to the provocation and disrupt the peace process. U.S. and Cuban officials are talking again about migration issues. In a meeting with reporters, an American spokesman has suggested the discussions could extend into the weekend. NPR's Trevor Rowe is at the site of the talks at the Cuban United Nations Mission in New York.
The talks had been expected to conclude later today, but U.S. spokesman David Johnson told reporters after this morning's meeting that he was not in a position to predict when the talks might end. He described the negotiations as serious, professional, and businesslike. He said the topics under discussion were legal migration, stopping the uncontrolled outflow, U.S. law enforcement measures, and the return of Cubans currently in U.S. jails. Johnson said that during the morning session, the two sides had given each other a number of concrete things to think about and suggested the afternoon session would be used to continue the exchange of ideas. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Greece called today for the West to ease the economic sanctions against Yugoslavia, to reward it for cutting off its aid to the rebel Bosnian Serbs. Russia has also urged a reduction in the sanctions. Both Greece and Russia have longtime ties to Serbia, the dominant republic in Yugoslavia. But Western nations don't want to lift any of the sanctions until Serbia agrees to allow international inspectors to watch the border to confirm that Serbia is not, in fact, supplying the Bosnian Serbs. In stock trading just before the close, the Dow was down 17.5 points in heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index was up a fraction of a point. This is NPR News. A judge has set a court date for October in the lawsuit brought by ousted NAACP leader Ben Chavis against the civil rights group. But as he set the date, Judge Richard Saltzman urged the two sides to settle the dispute out of court. Chavis has asked for an injunction allowing him to return to his job as executive director while his lawsuit works its way through the courts. Both sides say they have had talks but don't hold out much hope for a compromise. Chavis was fired by the NAACP's board after it was revealed that he used the group's funds to settle a sex discrimination suit brought by a former employee. On their third try, Russian cosmonauts aboard the orbiting Mir spaceship have succeeded in linking up with a craft carrying food and other supplies. The BBC's Martin Redfern reports.
For the Russians, with 20-year-old space technology, supply flights to Mir are as routine as anything can be in space. About five unmanned Progress supply craft ferry food and equipment up to the long-stay cosmonauts each year. This flight was like any other, except that it came just months before politically and economically important joint missions to Mir by European and American astronauts, and that it nearly ended in disaster. Twice the automatic docking sequence was initiated, only for the supply craft to fail to latch on to Mir. The only alternative was to guide the unmanned craft by hand. Sitting in the Soyuz ship already docked with Mir, the space station's commander, Yuri Malenchenko, guided Progress alongside with the aid of TV pictures from the craft relayed via Earth.
Martin Redfern in Moscow. The government says the U.S. unemployment rate held steady at 6.1% in August. The report also says the increase in new jobs for the month, 179,000, was the smallest since January and considerably less than most analysts had estimated. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Nathan Lane has the kind of voice that screams New York. Here he is as the voice of Timon Meerkat from the soundtrack of The Lion King.
I can see what's happening.
What?
And they don't have a clue.
Who?
They'll fall in love, and here's the bottom line. Our trio's down to two.
Oh.
The sweet caress of twilight. There's magic everywhere. And with all this romantic atmosphere, disaster's in the air.
Nathan Lane's New York sound was perfect when he starred in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. When he left that show, he starred in Neil Simon's Broadway comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. In movies, Lane played the gay next-door neighbor in Frankie and Johnny and co-starred with Michael J. Fox in Life with Mikey. If you missed him in all of the above, perhaps you'd recognize him as the coughing, sneezing guy from a recent NyQuil commercial. Before we hear the interview we recorded last January, let's hear Lane's duet with Faith Prince from the cast recording of Guys and Dolls.
Serve a paper and sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Give a holler and hate me, hate me. Go ahead, hate me.
Wind up in jail, don't come to me to bail you.
Already, it's true. So new. So sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you.
You're at it again. You're running the game. I'm not gonna play.
Was being on Broadway and Guys and Dolls everything you'd hoped?
And more. Was it everything I'd hoped? It really was. It was one of those times when everything sort of came together, and there were problems along the way, and I think it was interesting. We had a lot of time for rehearsal. We had about 7 weeks, and we didn't go out of town. And when you open in New York, you're really in a fishbowl here, and people, you know, don't wait. They like to go to the first preview and then get right home and call people and say, I hated it. And I think there was even more pressure. At first, we all thought, well, we're doing, you know, this classic musical. It's one of the best constructed and most beautifully written musicals in the world, but then you realize, well, all we can do is screw it up. So there is that sort of pressure, and everyone thinks they know how to do it, how it should be done.
Well, I knew how it should be done because of the summer camp production.
Right. Yeah. Everyone has done it. It's their favorite musical. So anyway, there was a lot of pressure, you know, people comparing it to the original, to the British production, or to their high school production. So
what would it take for you to cancel a performance if you weren't feeling well? How bad would you have to be feeling?
Cancel a performance? What kind of fascism is this?
Did you ever
There's
do it?
There's no such thing. Let's just forget you said that, Terry.
I mean, cancel you. I don't mean to cancel the whole show, but...
What?
Not
to go on?
For you not to go on.
Well, I would have to be, you know, have no speech whatsoever, if I had no voice at all. Or, I can remember in Merlin, Merlin, the magical musical for the entire family.
The short-lived magical musical.
No, it wasn't that short-lived.
It wasn't?
I was there for 10 months, ooh, so that's not that short. At one point in a number, I stepped off a boat off stage and broke a bone in my foot. And I didn't have to go on for the rest of the first act, and so they took me to a dressing room, and they put ice on it, and they went and bought a crutch at intermission, and I finished the show, the second act, on a crutch, and then I went to the emergency room afterwards, and they said, you're going to be in a cast for about 6 weeks. So I called the producers and on Monday, and you know, explained what had happened, and Merlin was a strange show. It was, you know, these magic tricks surrounded by musical numbers. It was Doug Henning and Cheetah Rivera, and I played Cheetah Rivera's son because of our striking physical resemblance. I'm often known as the Latin Spitfire of Broadway, Nathan Lane, and. So I called them and said, I'm going to be in this thing for 6 weeks. You know, do you want to put the understudy on? Do you want to get someone else? And it was a show in which I had ad-libbed my way through most of it. I was kind of the comic relief in this thing. And so no one knew what the real lines were anyway. And so they said, no, we'd rather have you do it on crutches if you think you can do it. And so for 6 weeks, we were in previews for very long, longer than any show, I think, in history. When we opened, people thought it was a revival. Stop! You're killing me. So and the show ran for 10 months, which just goes to prove that there's a lot of people in New Jersey. So I did the show for 6 weeks, and then I developed all this crutch business, you know? And then when my leg got better, I sort of hated to give up the crutches because I got a lot of sympathy from the audience.
So you're going to go on no matter what. This is your answer.
Oh, the great thing about the show was they made you sign a release, mm-hmm, you know, not to reveal how the tricks were done.
Yeah.
And
you're here to tell
us. I always
used
to think, well, isn't this like the tags on your mattress? If you take them off, who's going to know? Are the police, the magic police, going to break in? Did you tell her there were two horses up against the wall? You know, I told everyone how the tricks were done. Two drinks, and yeah, I gave everything away, all the secrets. Well, Doug Henning has gotten out of magic now, you know. He opened that transcendental theme park, you know, Lazaland. Did you know that? You know, where you sit on a pillow and imagine you're on a roller coaster? Oh, baby, I'm cooking now. Oh.
You're killing.
I'm killing.
Oh, well, you're back on Broadway now in the new Neil Simon show.
And better than ever.
Better than ever. He's back and he's better than ever.
I'm sober. The blackouts have stopped. I'm ready to work.
So the show is based on what it was like behind the scenes when all these great writers like Neil Simon were writing for your show of shows, the Sid Caesar show. And you play the Sid Caesar guy.
Yes. In the play, he's called Max Prince.
Right.
But yes, it's inspired by Sid Caesar. And
so did the laughs come at the same spot every night, at the same places every night?
No, it's you can. It's so that's sort of the amazing and wonderful thing about the theater. It changes every night, and some nights it's raucous and it's amazing how a large group of people just take on a personality. And there was like last night, there was a lady in the audience who was, I don't know, she was giving birth. I don't know what she was doing. She was screaming. She was doing her own show. And, sometimes that's infectious, and sometimes it just alienates 1,299 other people. And sometimes they think they're being helpful and they're not. And it's so weird because, someone can cough on a key word and then the moment is gone or the laugh is gone.
Can you recognize personality types now by the type of laugh that they have?
Personality types?
Uh-huh.
Well, there's the cougher's laugh. There's the guys that go, ha! There's the people who want to know, let everyone know that they got the joke. Ah, that was good. Ah, good. Yeah, I'm from Bayonne. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. People are funny. You never know what's going to happen.
Actor Nathan Lane is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're back with actor Nathan Lane. Tell us something about your early years, Nathan Lane, the early years. You grew up in New Jersey. It's a good place to start. Tell us something about your family.
My family? Oh, my family is, look up dysfunctional in the dictionary. Their picture is there. They're all waving. Yeah. I come from, don't make me do this. Don't make me go there. Don't make me see the pain. Yeah, my family is, I have two older brothers. What can I tell you about them? I was born and raised in Jersey City.
What'd your parents do for a living?
Poor but boring family. Uh-huh. What?
What'd your parents do for a living?
My father was a truck driver. My mother was a secretary and a manic depressive. But really, manic depression took up most of her time.
Were you the wisecracking kid?
Was I the wisecracking kid? What do you think, Terry?
Oh, I think it's possible.
What do you think? Yes, I was the wisecracking kid. Yeah, well, what did Abe Lincoln say? If I didn't laugh, I'd cry. My childhood was tough. My father died when I was about 11. He was an alcoholic. And actually, my mother did go through manic depression for many years. But it made her a colorful character in the neighborhood. And then finally, she was put on lithium, that wonderful drug.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of balances you out. I always thought if I took it, would I become an accountant and move to Ohio?
Did it help
her? It's a joke, Terry. Work with me. Anyway, the family is very happy now. They're all fine now. It was really my older brother, Dan, who got me interested in the theater. He's a teacher, and he would take his classes over to plays in New York, and he would take me with him. And that's how I got interested in the theater. And eventually I moved to New York and became a struggling, starving actor. You know, had all those, strange jobs you have to do to
Such
make
as?
A living. Well, I used to deliver singing telegrams, happy hysterectomy, happy hysterectomy, it was like ridiculous. And people hate when you deliver singing telegrams. I did this for a very long time. Congratulations, Shirley, your stretch marks hardly show. And it was terrible. It's a terrible job.
Who wrote the songs?
They did. They would tell them whatever the occasion was, and they would put it, you know, set it to a popular tune, or, you know, one that was you didn't have to pay any royalties on. And then I used to sell TV Guide by phone. I used to do those surveys, the Harris Poll surveys, and what else? That was about it. I never waited on tables, so I just couldn't do that. I don't know why. I just thought of serving people. I don't know. I just couldn't do it.
I think your big break came when you started working with playwright Terrence McNally, who...
No, I was pretty successful before him.
Were you?
Sure. I was on Broadway with George C. Scott and Present Laughter.
Was that before that?
Oh, yeah. Oh. And I did a play with Simon Gregg called The Common Pursuit. And yes, I had a television series. I know. He likes to think he took me out of the gutter. But no, I'd done a couple of things before I met him. But yes, thank God I did, because it certainly really did turn things around for me when we did a play of his called The Lisbon Traviata.
You've been in your share of flops, too.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. How does it feel to be in a flop? Is it really, do you get really, really depressed and insecure?
No, you feel great.
You feel great.
Because, you know, there's nothing like living on the edge, knowing you're going down for the count. Yes, of course you're depressed. It's a flop. That's the big difference. If you're in a hit, you feel good. Flop, bad. Hits, good. Yes, that's what happens. You're depressed. But there's something, it's like being on the Titanic. There's nothing like the camaraderie of people in a flop, believe me. And I've certainly had my share.
Could you see it coming? The shows at
flop? Oh, sure. Sometimes the first day of rehearsal. You just look across the room and it all spells doom. It rhymed. Hey, I'm one of the poets you're interviewing. There's something, you know. I just saw this really strange movie the other night. I rented this movie because a woman in the video store recommended it. A total stranger said, have you seen Jennifer 8? And I said, no. And she said, oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And I rented it. And it was, you know, a bizarre movie. And this was sort of like a pretentious thriller. But one of my favorite line in the movie was one of the cops is talking about someone they're investigating. And he says, I don't know. I sniff grief. I sniff grief, he said. So that's what happens when you're in a flop.
Right.
Next time I'm in one, I'm going to say, hey, I sniff grief.
So are you still preparing to do a revival of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum? I read that was in the works.
Yes.
So will you get to sing comedy tonight?
I will. I'll be the one who comes out and sings that.
That should be fun.
It should. It's a great show. It's funny, not a lot of people know the show that well. They know the movie, which was very weird because they kind of ruined it in a way. They made it very realistic, and so you actually saw, you know, horse poop in the streets, people sweating in ancient Rome, and it was ugh. But it wasn't pleasant. When they talk about mare's sweat, they actually saw a cup of it. You don't want to see these things. But the play itself is, it's certainly the funniest book ever written for a musical, and I think Mr. Sondheim is going to write a couple of new songs.
Wow.
It should be very exciting. Jerry Zaks, who directed Guys and Dolls, is going to direct it.
He directed the Neil Simon show, too,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Right.
We're inseparable now.
Yeah.
We're all getting aloft.
Well, Nathan Lane, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And hey, lighten up, you know?
Okay.
Nathan Lane recorded last January. This fall, he'll star in Terrence McNally's off-Broadway play, Love, Valor, Compassion. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The U.S. is going to be talking next week with North Korean officials about the possibility of establishing diplomatic ties. The arrangement would be to set up liaison offices in both capitals. Martha Raddatz on the possibility of an invasion of Haiti. I'll talk with a historian about the possibility 30 years ago of a U.S. first strike against the Soviet Union. My colleague Robert Siegel's been traveling in Pennsylvania, talking there with voters about the crime legislation which has passed and health legislation which has not. Also, music for a summer evening gathered among singer-songwriters who got together last September on Martha's Vineyard.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Thank you. can a white, yeshiva-educated writer-director make a film about life among New York's black drug gangs? That's what 29-year-old Boaz Yakin has done in his debut movie. Film critic Stephen Schiff took a look at Fresh.
Strangely enough, what feels most authentic in this movie is the inner-city atmosphere. Boaz Yakin says he prepared for his film by hanging out briefly at a school in Brooklyn. If that's all he did, he's a quick study. Scene for scene, the movie is taut, well-written, and evocative. And Yakin doesn't waste any time. From the movie's first few minutes, we know that its title character, 12-year-old Fresh, is a drug runner, balancing his days between the local crack dealers and the neighborhood's big-time heroin pusher, Esteban, played by Giancarlo Esposito. Esteban likes Fresh. He thinks the kid has a future in dope dealing.
You find your niche, you stay there, stay cool, and you be the man into your 50s and 60s. And then you retire your old ass to a nice condo someplace hot with a lot of nice Jewish people. Hey, you leave the business for your kids. Hey, it's like banking, only it's more secure. And you don't pay no taxes.
As fatherly as Esteban may be, he's a predator. And his latest prey is Fresh's beautiful older sister, a junkie who bounces from one dealer's arms to another's. Meanwhile, Fresh has to contend with school, with the aunt who's raising him along with 11 other kids, and with his own real father, played by Samuel L. Jackson. He's a chess hustler who's estranged from the rest of the family. And though he doesn't show Fresh much warmth or affection, he does teach him the ways of the chessboard.
And what kind of player am I? Am I an offensive man or a defensive man? That's right, I'm neither. I play my opponent. If he likes to attack, I force him to defend himself. If he's a cautious man, I draw him into dangerous waters. See, you get so frustrated playing defensive positions, you make stupid moves you'd never make if you were thinking. When you come here, boy, check that at the door.
So, does Fresh break out of Brooklyn and head for Harvard on a chess scholarship? No, but what he does do is a lot more interesting. Using the strategic thinking his father has drummed into his head, he sets up every gangster and goon in his neighborhood, fooling them into destroying one another and themselves. Yakin has planned his movie cleverly. At first, it's his evocation of the ghetto that draws you in, and just when that begins to pall, his plot begins to twist and jump. What's missing, though, is character. Sean Nelson, who plays Fresh, is remarkably self-possessed, but he's not much more than that. He's an inexpressive young actor who can't make Fresh seem more than a cipher. And the kids who play his young posse are even worse. Yakin's dialogue is smart enough, but these young actors can't deliver it. And Yakin may be too inexperienced to know how to disguise bad acting. Instead of cutting around the shaky performances, he dotes on them. Still, the movie is fascinating for what it does accomplish. The violence in Fresh isn't as constant and in-your-face as the violence in Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society, but that makes it startlingly effective. It leaps out of the shadows at you and curdles your blood. And even Fresh's blankness makes the world he's forced to live in seem all the more appalling. As for Boaz Yakin, well, if he can conjure up other worlds as effectively and convincingly as he's conjured up the inner city, he's going to be a very valuable commodity in Hollywood.
Stephen Schiff writes for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf. Our week-long retrospective is produced by Roberta Shurrock. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.